to Stories from the Ashes, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I'm your host, Amber, and I am here today with my husband, Eric, who some of you Hello. Know from his time on Reshelving Alexandria and before he went into early social media retirement and his time helping with keeping the website and all of its associated database, et cetera, up and running for us. So welcome, Eric.
It's a pleasure, as always, every day.
So we try to get to know our guests by asking them about their reading life. And I know that it's a running joke on Facebook that you are a non-reader, but you have read and you do read, just not possibly to the level of some of the other people around you. But I'm wondering what three of the most influential or favorite books in your life have been.
Yes, so I may not be prolific, but I like to think I have taste. So I think you told me that the average guest says, oh, I have to narrow it down from hundreds. Well, for me, it's dozens, and maybe two dozen is, it's still dozens, by the way. but in all seriousness, I feel like some of the books that have influenced me are books that really make a time period come alive. Mm-hmm. I think for some people, maybe that's easier. Maybe that's just natural for a lot of voracious readers. They can take in any book and that story comes alive. That hasn't always been my experience, but there have definitely been some like time period based pieces where, works that have really connected with me. So one of them in that vein has been Great Gatsby. I think that I was at a point in my reading life where like I was a senior in high school. And so I just didn't really care anymore because previously I'd worked really hard to gain understanding of books like Lord of the Flies and Shakespeare and some of those works, and just really struggled when just told, no, that's not what that means at all. What is the meaning of the old man? What is the meaning of the sea? I'm like, I don't know, man, they're just words. Like, why are you bothering me with all these questions?
The best way to kill a love of reading is definitely to have it taught to you in a school setting by probably 90% of literary teachers, because there's not a lot of joy in over dissecting things the way you're describing.
Yeah, I feel like reading was turned into something that was like open-ended, and what do you get from it? And it could mean multiple things. To all of a sudden there was like this very precise meaning, and you had to look at the world and the book this certain way or it was wrong. And
right.
I just didn't carry in a lot of that stuff naturally. And so I kind of resisted that in high school. But by the time I was a senior, I just didn't care anymore. And so we, got into some books like Great Gatsby, which weren't that abstract. They were fairly accessible, not too long. Mm-hmm. And like really made the like 1920s period come alive. So yeah, I think that was one that really connected with me. And there are a couple others that, similarly impacted me. There was one we read, I think in middle school, called The Pig Man, that had a similar effect with like the 1960s. And I remember things like how to dial the operator on a rotary phone. If the rotary wasn't working, you just tap the receiver thing like 10 times or whatever. So I don't know if that was actually true at the time, but there was stuff like mm-hmm. that where it's just like, wow, that's what life was like then. I think
we had a rotary phone when I was growing up, and that was one of my favorite things, except for when I was trying to win call-in contests on the kids programs on the radio station, and then it just took too long to dial and I just couldn't do it. So when we got a touch phone, that was exciting, and I started winning call-in contests.
So did you ever try tapping the hang up part 10 times?
No, I didn't. I really enjoy rotaries, and I wish that they were still a thing. Like if they came out with a rotary cell phone, I would be first in line, but it needs to have the same weight as a real rotary phone, and it needs to make the same clicking noises. It's just very sensory, delightful in my book.
Yeah. So we had a phone that was a touchtone phone, but you could flip the mode to like pulse mode, I think is what it was called. And so it like simulated a rotary in terms of like it sent these pulse sounds through rather than as if it was clicking.
Yeah.
The rotary was clicking or whatever. And so after I read that book, The Pigman, I tried putting our phone onto pulse mode and seeing if I could like tap it. It didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Eric, I just had a life realization. I think that my love of rotary phones led to my love of slot machines. Now, just to clarify for everyone, I'm not a slot machine girl, but on our honeymoon, we went to a casino for the buffet and we each had $20 and I just wanted to do the slots. But I think it's the same thing. It's this heavy weight that you pull and then it makes that click, 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 clicking noise like the rotary phone when it's spinning back, and then there's a result. And I never even cared about the result. Like I really, if I could pay to just sit there and like pull the knob and listen to the click, click, clicking for a long time, I would pay that. Even like, you know, if it's like $10 for a day of clicking, I'd be down for that. But I think that's what the connection is. I think that the sensory aspect of playing a slot machine is the same as the sensory feedback that my happy little autistic self gets from dialing a rotary phone. And I love it.
And you did pay for it.
I did pay for it. I paid $20 for it.
Yep. I think you were up a few dollars at one point. And then at the time, it seemed like you were interested in like the flashing lights. You're just like, whoa, the flashing lights. Look at all this.
No, it's the ding, ding, ding. Oh, I think ding, I want something. And then to the click, click, click.
Yeah. Gotcha. Oh, man. Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. That was fun.
So we need to find me an old rotary phone from a garage sale that I can just spin the wheel on.
Yeah. So that was two books, but that's really one book. So we're going to call that book period pieces that I can understand. Because, you know, if you go to like Jane Austen, like I don't understand that stuff. Like they're making all these references to social order and all that stuff. I'm like, I don't get any of that. So I don't know. I don't know that I would find those books that interesting, even if they are accurate to the period. But 1920s, 1960s, those were kind of accessible enough for me that, you know. And now I feel like at least in the movies and TV, it's almost become like a trope where it's like reductionist and very oversimplified, a lot of the nostalgia stuff. So it's like you just play the song from that period, except it's like 5 years off, and then, you know, have people dressed like in exaggerated, you know, whatever, and then make it seem like, oh yeah, it's totally what the 80s was like. Yeah, I don't think so.
Just very stereotypical instead of realistic.
Yeah. So I don't know that in general the nostalgia genre is like something I go for, but there are cases for it. So another one, Boxcar Children. There were mysteries. It was like little kids doing things that were kind of above their station in life, seemingly, and having to figure it out on their own. So those were always intriguing. And they were always in high demand in our school library. And so it was like, get them while you can. Read all 25, you know. And then why is Mystery Behind the Wall? Why is that one always checked out? Like, you know, that was a mystery in itself. Like, who has that book? Why is it never in? Why is it always gone by the time, you know, anyway? So, and I was never good at solving the mysteries, but I enjoyed reading them.
That's how I felt about Encyclopedia Brown. I never could figure out the mystery that he solved, but I loved being able to see both sides of it, being able to see the mystery playing out and hoping that I would catch the clues and maybe sometimes catching them. Or at least knowing where something was off, even if I didn't know how to apply that knowledge. But then I also loved the fact that they had the answers in the back told in story form. So it wasn't just one sentence and then you had to figure out what you had missed, but it was almost a continuation of the story with a couple paragraphs of you know, this is what Encyclopedia saw and when he saw it and how it played out and how he ended up solving the case. And I really liked being able to see both sides.
Yeah. Yes. Encyclopedia Brown was another one that definitely that I enjoyed as well. I remember there was one where whoever did the crime said that they were woken up by the thunder and then they saw lightning afterward. That was the tell right there. Yep. Of course, never mind that there can be multiple lightning and thunders, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, let's forget that. But we are going to hone in on the scientific fact that thunder comes mm-hmm. after lightning. We found the liar. Yep. Case solved.
Yep.
Thank you, Encyclopedia Brown. But anyway, so yeah, mysteries are definitely one that I've always enjoyed, which then led to Goosebumps, and you know, we can camp out there or avoid that one. That was kind of the middle school. Everybody was reading it. There were mysteries, I guess. There weren't like high quality, obviously, but again, with the numbered series, it was just like, wow, you're reading number 25 and I'm only a number 5. I got to catch up. Like, it was just, I don't know, almost a little competition, I guess. Maybe that was just me thinking that. But yeah, mysteries were definitely another genre I enjoyed. And then third would be like military. And I don't know that I actually read Tom Clancy, but like that genre. There was one in particular that I read, Red Phoenix by Larry Bond, that really, I think, impacted me. It was like, it was as if like the Korean War started back up basically in like the late 80s, early 90s. And so to me, that idea was just crazy. Like, wow, these kind of things could lead to like world war, and just kind of thinking through that kind of, you know, how world events cascade and stuff like that, which is definitely, it impacted me then, and I think it's continued to be an interest for me today. There's enough of it going on in nonfiction, though, so I'm not really looking at a whole lot of fiction in that area. So I would say those. And then I guess honorary mention would be dystopian genre. I think in high school, in the period where I had kind of not enjoyed reading, I tended to go for like the shorter dystopian novels, like 1984, Animal Farm, that was good and short, Clockwork Orange, Slaughterhouse-Five. That might have been it. I don't know that I actually read any more than those, but you know, that genre appealed to me as well. Mm-hmm. Just thinking about like what people were seeing as the future in like the 1940s, 1950s, and a lot of it was, you know, there was a lot of reason for optimism, but there were some people who saw a dark side to it, and that was interesting to me as well, how people would see the future.
Yeah.
That's my 3.5, 4, bordering on 10, but yeah, anyway.
Okay, so we received some submitted questions from our Reshelving Alexandria Facebook group that people had for you. So I thought would intersperse a few of those. Question one, what is your favorite genre for yourself, and what is your favorite to read aloud? And do you even enjoy reading aloud?
I do. I enjoy reading kids' books aloud. Fox in Socks is a big one for me. Definitely. I enjoy reading that to the kids. I enjoy the challenge of it. At one point, I would say I mastered it to the almost the same level I mastered Minesweeper and Solitaire on Windows PCs, but maybe not quite as good. I mean, I was good at Solitaire and Minesweeper. I was pretty good at Fox and Sock. But
for those who are curious why I'm laughing so much about Fox and Socks, is because not only does Eric enjoy reading that to the kids, but Fox and Socks is probably my least favorite Dr. Seuss. And so Eric likes subjecting me to it, which means if I'm in the shower, he will just come in and start reciting it, knowing that I am a captive audience and I have nowhere to go. So yes, Fox and Socks lives in infamy in our family, and he definitely has mastered it.
I mean, that's better than dumping cold water on you, right?
I agree. If it's one or the other, so. I'll take Fox and Socks.
So yeah, I think definitely, you know, a selection of children's books, and I'm, you know, I don't have to really work that hard to select them. They tend to get selected for me. Thank you for that. So we've had some good ones. Sandra Boynton was an author that we did a lot of board book reading, and currently we're working on a series with our 5-year-old, and she's interested in them mostly every night, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she reads them with you as well. I was just trying to think if she reads them with you, but I forget what they're called. But it's like, let's talk about whining. Let's talk about tattling. Let's talk about cheating. Let's talk, you know, it's probably the Let's Talk About series.
Yeah, it is, by Joy Berry. I think those were published in the 70s or the 60s. So they're a little bit dated, but they're very nice, simplistic breakdowns of what the definitions of different words are and how it might play out and what the social repercussions of living your life a specific way may be. So they're really good. Some people don't like them because they think that they are oversimplified, but we have found that for children with language deficits or very black and white thinking with autism, that they're very useful in just very clearly saying it like it is and having very clear illustrations that help again with that language deficit in understanding what is being described and demonstrated. So they have a place on our shelves, that's for sure.
Yep. And they're getting read, that's for sure. So I think, you know, the selection tends to rotate a little bit. I tend to just go for what's there, assuming that some book fairy magically places them within reach of myself or the children. Maybe just take that for granted a little bit. I mean, obviously I, you know, want to make sure I agree with the books and connect with them as well. But Amber, you have a pretty good intuition, probably. Yeah. Intuition there. Instinct, even better. Instinct. Yes. So that's, definitely read those aloud. Enjoy doing that. Really from birth up to 5 or 6 is when I spend the most, probably the most time doing that with our kids, historically. Although I am branching out into, what is it? Like Math Doesn't Suck. Mm-hmm. What's that one? What's it called?
By your hero.
Yeah.
Your childhood hero. That's what it's called. One of your first crushes. Math Doesn't Suck by Donica. What's her last name?
By McKellar. Yep. Winnie Cooper. Yes, Winnie Cooper. McKellar. That's who it is. So yeah, branching out and reading that to our 17-year-old. 16? Is she 16?
Yeah, she's 16.
Did I say 17?
Stop aging her. I keep aging her too and telling people 17, and then my heart breaks and I realize it's because I'm dreading 17. Because 17's so close to 18. But yeah, she's 16. She does believe that math sucks. And so Eric went ahead and we have a copy of Math Sucks from before the fire, but it is still in storage somewhere. So you bought a new copy and you're reading it to her before bedtime, because that's when every teen wants to do math reading with their dad, is at bedtime.
That's right.
That gives you good dreams.
This one is autographed. This one is autographed. Yes, it is. So we trade it up, that's for sure.
Yep. And I just wanted to say that you do the majority of the reading aloud when they are in that 0 to 5 range, because I can't handle the repetition of favorite books. I love the repetition of favorite books, and I respect it by making sure the kid owns their favorite book, but I cannot personally read the same book 100 times in a day. I will lose my mind. And so I really appreciate the fact that you will read the book 1 million times in a row, and that they are getting that in their young age. And then when it comes to like chapter read alouds, I feel like that's where I shine. I curate the books for when they're little, but I just I will reject it if they bring me the same book for the fifth time in a day. And I will be like, here's some other books to choose from that mommy is willing to read. And you can save that one for bedtime with daddy. And they usually go fine for that, or they find an older sibling at this point that can read it to them over and over ad nauseum. But I do appreciate the team element that we have in you being willing to do that for them.
Thank you, by the way. As far as the favorite genre, I mean, I think the most impactful genre was and I don't know what it would be called, because I think books accurate to a certain time that I can understand, I don't know that that's really a genre, but those have definitely been the most impactful books for me, where I've really been able to understand and learn from them.
That's historical fiction. So it is a genre, and it's a well-respected genre. It's a genre where the stories are fiction, but the historical aspects are dead on accurate. And so we do a lot of historical fiction for homeschool, because it's the best way to learn history is somebody who highly respects the historical era to accurately depict everything historical in the book, and then just gives you a beautiful story that fits into that time period on top of it. Pretty much everything that I remember about the Revolutionary War from my time as a student is because I read Johnny Tremaine over and over, and the history is accurate for what was going on in the battles and what was going on in the timeline and what was going on in that period. But the story sucked me in, and so it helped me to remember all of that, whereas what I was reading in my textbooks was dry and bored me to tears, literally. And I read to the test and then dumped it. But the things that I was reading in historical fiction are what stuck for my history.
Okay. That's good to know. So I would say then, with that information, I would say historical fiction. But then if you gave me a specific one, there's a good chance I'd say, well, not that historical fiction. But I don't know. I'll explore it some more. How's that sound?
Sounds good. If you wrote a book, what would the topic or genre be?
Probably satire. So I would say, trying to remember the story, but basically in middle school, we did a kind of a unit study as a group on Jurassic Park, and we did some activities. And so one of those activities was, as a group, write up like a short story that you then act out. I think those are called plays. Is that what those are? Yeah. A play, basically, of a sequel to Jurassic Park. And so I was like, let's do this. It was like, I think like at that point, the 2000 Olympics hadn't happened yet. It was like 1996 or seven. But they were going to be in Sydney. So I'm like, I remember Jurassic Park. It was like some island off of South America. So that's in the Southern Hemisphere. What if the dinosaurs escaped the island, swam to Australia, and it took like 3 years, and they're showing up at the Olympics and just raising havoc. So that was the basis of the story. And so we developed that. But the twist that kind of ruined it was our teacher made the strategic error of just throwing in like, well, you know, the book had some swearing, so if you have a few words in there, you know, you can... Yeah. So imagine where that went. Now that wasn't me, that wasn't my part, but basically I would say I provided the skeleton of the story, and then the meat of the story was basically just people swearing. And so, yeah.
So close, but yet so far.
Right. So yeah, I feel like for me to take something that is understood and known, or sort of well known, well understood, and sort of like flip it on its head or add some twist to it, or I mean, in some cases, mock it, I guess. And, you know, sometimes satire does that. I feel like that's where I enjoy writing. You know, I enjoy, like, there was, I don't know. I think that's a pretty consistent thing that I like across writing and movies and, like, the type of comedy that I like and stuff like that, too. So I would say that's my, that's, is that a genre? Is that an appropriate genre?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the
sounds good
official government catalog of genres, is that the, that's one of them? Okay. Yeah. So we'll go with satire.
Congress has that one.
Okay.
So one of our members would like to know if you knew what you were getting into when you married me, and if you have any advice to other bewildered and slightly defeated husbands whose wives keep bringing books home.
So short answer is no, I did not know what I was getting into. It was almost 10 years before I realized, and maybe I should have been paying more attention. But I remember, you know, in our first home, like, oh, we had two bookshelves. Whoa, that seems like a little bit much, but you know, I guess I had some books from college I didn't want to get rid of either. So, okay, fine. But then about 10 years in, the ideas, the planning and the designing rooms around bookshelves started a little more earnestly. And then I think I saw more clearly what your love of books was and what your vision was with that love of books. And, you know, at first it was a little bit scary and confusing. And I didn't like tripping over boxes, but then I saw blessings coming with it as well. And I was able to see the fruit that it was bearing in your life, Amber, and a lot of good fruit, you know. So I think my advice would be to make sure that love and that desire is honored in the relationship, and that there's space for that, you know, give space to accommodate for that, even to the point of a bit of discomfort. Not that it can't get out of hand at times. And I know we've, you know, had some discussions about that. And I think it's good to have that discussion as well. And try to think about, you know, budgeting space and time and making sure everybody's still on board. I think that's always healthy. But I would say, you know, if there's a love of reading, a love of books, a love of literature, overall, that's a good thing. And I think it's good to make a little more than reasonable accommodations for that. And hopefully that bears out in how the marriage and the relationship works as well. And, you know, take some time and go enjoy some sports too. You know, don't make it all about books or whatever your interest is.
I do love going out in the canoe. So this wife would like to know how to inspire a husband to read again, who formerly read quite a lot, mostly theology as well as classics and some mysteries, but seems to be in a slump for the past number of years. Without nagging, she'd love to read and discuss books together more, but hasn't seemed able to find one that he's truly interested in. I would actually like to say something to that real quick, and then you can jump in. My first thing would be to point out the fact that he probably was reading to himself theology, classics, and mysteries, and wondering if there isn't an auditory portion of not being able to feel like he's interested in what book is being read aloud and discussed together. Because I think that we have found that with you over the years, understanding more about auditory processing disorders and the fact that you just take in information a lot better when you read it yourself versus listening. Like, I would love to read aloud to you, and I do anyway sometimes, but just understanding that you're not connecting to it and you're basically just sitting there to spend time with me versus to spend time with the story. And maybe what would be more beneficial for them would be listening to a book on audio, or where one person's reading aloud and the other person's reading along together, that might be what part of the issue is, but also just time of life. I think so. My place of comfort in a storm would be to read, whereas your place of comfort in a storm would be to do something. And I think there's more of the, you know, Jesus sleeping not that I'm saying I'm Jesus, but like that element of like one person being able to sleep during the storm and then the disciples being like, how are you sleeping? Like, we're all going to drown. and they want to be doing, right? They want to be doing something to save everybody. And so I think we see that a lot in couples where one person is more of a rester and the other person's more of a doer in different situations. And so you may want to have a personal assessment within your marriage and your life as to whether this is a time of storm and whether your recommendation for what you want to do together to connect is something that just the other person's internally bucking at because it doesn't feel like doing anything and it doesn't feel like it's going to change anything or make any progress in what's happening. And so it may not be the right thing at the right time as much as it is a good thing. I'm just thinking about after our fire. If I had been like, hey, let's do a read aloud together at night, you would have been like, oh my goodness, with what time? And then you would have resented it and been stressed out by it instead of finding it a good way to connect with all the other things that we really did need to be working through and discussing and planning with the house rebuild and the storage and cleaning and all of that. Those are just my thoughts. Did you have any?
Yeah, those are good thoughts. I would say I'm still working through this myself, so I don't know that I can say from the other side of anything what I would advise. But I think getting to a point where first he can understand why, and then, you know, maybe working with him on that. And not just why, like, oh, I don't have time, or oh, I, you know, like, really, why? Like, I think for me, it's been helpful to like look a little deeper. And I'd say even just thinking of the notes that I wrote for the podcast, thinking about like, why did I go to The Pig Man? Like some random book that I read like 25 years ago. What stuck out about that to me? Why does that book matter to me that I even remembered it? Mm-hmm. And making that connection to like time period stuff and Great Gatsby, you know, more of those connections, more of that understanding is always good. And I think can help facilitate a good dialogue between you two, and then ultimately get him excited about what he's interested in. I think that part of the season of life thing is like, you know, don't think about yourself, think about others. Don't think about what you want. Just, you know, get through the day. And that can become a rut that people fall in for sure. And they're not taking care of themselves nearly as much. So no idea if that applies at all here, but I think, yeah, getting that deeper understanding and talking through it together, I think will be helpful no matter what comes out of it with reading. But I think having him rediscover what brought him joy in reading in the first place, I think will always be a helpful thing. And it's good that you want to walk with him on that.
I agree. So something that we have done in our family is find ways to put the images of what we are reading in front of our kids as often as possible because of those language processing challenges that are oldest son has in particular, and he's turning 11 this year, and I really want him to be able to engage and comprehend what is going on in the stories that we are reading aloud or listening to on audiobooks. And he was our kid that literally would scream up until the age of 5 anytime we tried to read aloud to him. I don't know if you've blocked that out or not, Eric, but that was Knightley's response to trying to have books read to him, even little board books. He would just scream bloody murder. He didn't start talking until he was about 4, 4.5. And then he did like listening to picture books. But when I tried to start leveling up into chapter books, there was zero ability to narrate in any of the formats that we have used. So for our girls who just were overwhelmed at the idea of verbal narration and felt that it was like a test, we had them color pictures or build Legos and tell us about the story through the Legos or act it out. And I found with our son that he really just, he was getting nothing from the verbal storytelling. And so I went and I found all these Scholastic DVDs that I remembered from when I would babysit for people. And we would put them on in the van where he was a captive audience. And I would just go and drive around with the kids up and down the river for about an hour every afternoon. And we would just watch these picture books that were all the picture books I wanted to read to him that he wouldn't sit for at home. But as a captive audience in the van, he had no choice. And he started to fall in love with these stories and these characters and specific illustrators, because the pictures are very similar to how they would be in Reading Rainbow when we were growing up, where it just kind of was like the page would turn and there might be very slight movement in the illustrations, or like one character on the page would move. And so it wasn't like watching a cartoon by any means. But now he recognizes illustrators and he recognizes characters, and we've kind of leveled up with chapter books into watching the movie first, which I never thought I would be someone who would do that. And I definitely am 99% in the camp of the book was better. And so this has been a stretch of doing the right thing for the kid, because every kid needs something different. And so watching the movie with him first gives him the ability to make mental pictures that he, or to hang the information on something, since he isn't making mental pictures, because now his brain thinks it knows what those kids look like. Now the brain finally knows what the boat is that's being described. I'm thinking specifically of the Swallows and Amazons. I watched that with the kids last week because it's going to be one of our car books for dance season. And I wanted him to have any idea of what was going on and where the story was going and what the characters were doing. And then we have the ability to point out the differences between the story and the movie as we go. But I know that you liked Reading Rainbow a lot as a kid in a similar situation of just really enjoying the visuals.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned there's that one book where the guy was selling hats. I'm like, caps for sale. Hello, yeah. Reading Rainbow. What's up? That one stuck with me. We talked about it a little bit and it was interesting because I think, Reading Rainbow had like a bit of variety. There was some visual aspect to it, but there was even more. Like it was, you see that book on the television. It's like famous because it's on TV. And then you walk down to your school library and there's that same book and you're like, I got to get my hands on that. Mm-hmm. Get it now. And then everyone else is thinking the same thing. So it's checked out. But then you go to the Scholastic Book Fair down the hall. It's there. And you're like, take my money. I got to read the Reading Rainbow thing. And oh, by the way, this one has a Caldecott medal. So it has pretty pictures and it's amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, Reading Rainbow, they had a good, they had a nice tight system going there. That's for sure. Now to contrast a little bit, there was that other show, like Books Cover to Cover, I think is what it was called. And it was a bit more dry. And the guy had like a mustache. He looked like Captain Kangaroo or something with a haircut. So I don't know. I don't think that's it though. Like he looked like someone else. I can't remember. Either way. And he'd like draw while the story's being told. I'm like, what is he drawing? Oh man, I'm falling asleep here. That one did not connect with me nearly as much. No offense to any cover to cover lovers.
No offense to anyone, but he was not a Caldecott winner. So.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, you know, E for effort for sure. But that just wasn't my style. So yeah, in Reading Rainbow, that was, I mean, like we got to see how they did the disappearing on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Yeah.
I mean, we got to see all that stuff. It was great. Got to see stuff about weather, it was good.
There's that show now, Mythbusters. And whenever I think of Mythbusters, I always think of how Reading Rainbow was my version of Mythbusters as a kid. Like it was our version of that. because I remember one episode where LeVar was talking about goats and the fact that goats won't actually eat a tin can, which is in one of these picture books, and that goats actually are much more picky than they are shown to be. And he like went to a farm with all these goats and was trying to feed them different things. And I was like, whoa, I had no idea. I thought goats would really eat a tin can because it was in the book and the book would never lie. So I think that reading Rainbow also helped me to learn to question everything. Like, just because it's in a book does not mean that it's the gospel truth, and I need to test everything, and I need to see, do other books agree? Is this a joke that the author was making? Because as a very black and white thinker as a kid, it took a while for me to realize that a lot of things that authors say is tongue in cheek or is sarcastic, and it may not come across in text very clearly. And so, you know, sarcasm isn't something to be believed. It's something to be chuckled about. But if you don't know it's chuckleable and you just believe it, then you're just stuck believing something that isn't accurate. So I really appreciate reading Rainbow for helping me to know that goats won't eat tin cans and to question some of what I'm being fed in my books.
Nice. And one thing I also liked about it was, you know, in between their segments, they had that little sound. It was like, boop, boop.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to like
That's
insert
it. You
that
liked
here.
The sound. Oh, you're gonna
we're just
going to
like
here
insert that
sound.
Here. Ba-dump, bump. Yeah, so another, you know, this is maybe a change in topic a little bit, but another story that kind of sticks out to me with reading was we did a class-wide read aloud to Where the Red Fern Grows. And so we got to the chapter where, I don't know, should I give it away? Well, you know what? There's a website I think you were telling me about.
There's a website called doesthedogdie.com. And if you want to know what happens and where the red fern grows one way or the other, you can consult Does the Dog Die?
So, yes. So I will not give it away. But at a very strategic part of that book, everyone in the class was just bawling, could not even speak. And except me. So I was called upon to get through that part. And I did so successfully.
As the reader, you had to step in for the teacher.
Yeah. Maybe read alouds didn't connect with me quite as much as other kids, I guess. The lesson there. Because I know I do get sad at, you know, sad things. I'm definitely capable of that. But yeah, somehow that story just didn't connect with me as it did other people. So that's another funny anecdote with myself in reading. But I guess it, you know, it kind of speaks to people having different ways that they connect with literature, and I guess the read aloud. Yeah. You know, I think I made it through a lot and was able to understand some books when they were read, you know, aloud earlier in life, but never really connected deeply that way. So,
mm-hmm. I can just picture that you stoically reading while everyone's sobbing.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and there were a couple people in particular that I was like, no way that they're crying. And then I look up and they're just, and that threw me. I was like, wow, I am the last man standing here. What is going on? This is really awkward.
I feel like,
am I missing
that
something
book's
here?
A rite of passage for most kids for having their heart broken by literature. Because that was the first book club that I took part in when I was like 14. My friend was throwing this book club, and her mom, who I think secretly hated all of us, had recommended that book. And so we all read it, and then we came back together, and we were all just kind of looking at each other, like waiting for the first person to admit that this had not been an easy read. And then we were all just really mad at her mom because we were like, you did not warn us. This was supposed to be a fun book club. And we're all just like brokenhearted, sobbing into our cornflakes. And It was traumatic to go into with no warning. But the thing about that book is there is warning. The author literally says it on the first page. So I don't feel bad saying it here. The dogs die. The author states it on the first page, but most people miss it and don't really understand what he's saying. But the dogs die. And I think like the first dog dying was rough. But the second dog dying, I just about died of a broken heart there too. And it was I have been avoiding reading that book to our children. But I think this is the year, because the girls can't leave home without hearing it. And so I think we're going to do it. Ugh. I am not looking forward to this at all. You know what? I'm going to make Ever come too. Everhart's going to have to sit in with the girls.
Ooh. That'll be good. That'll be good. And I guess if you need a little help.
I'll call you in for the last two chapters. I'll be like angry, angry knitting in the corner.
I don't know. I may not be the same anymore. I don't know.
I think you've had a little more life under your belt now, that some of that may feel a little more close to home.
Yeah.
So we had one more question from Reshelving Alexandria. And this question was, imagining when you are 109 years old, because they clearly know that you are of hardy stock because everyone in your family lives almost to 100. So imagine when you're 109 years old and you look back on the life that the two of us have built together. What do you see as the most valuable aspects, plurality?
I think the most important aspects, I think of it like a foundation. I think the eternal and the things that will last beyond myself, beyond us, to future generations, which include faith for our own sake, and the children's sake and their children's children's sake, but also having children, and helping them to build relationships with ourselves and with each other, that will prepare them to go out and live life and repeat that cycle. But once they're out, they're not really out. I mean, I'm 40 and I'm still learning things that it's like, maybe I should have known that when I was 18, but I don't, and I'm going to keep learning. So a lifelong love of learning, lifelong love of improving, I think is a gift that we'll keep on giving as well. And something that we can instill in our children, but also, cultivate in our own relationship and in ourselves. I think that those things I described are maybe sort of a restating or more fleshed out version of these three things remain: faith, hope, and love. And that's kind of how I see them playing out in the life of our family and in our marriage. And that will, you know, I think at times we've had one step forward, two steps back, and that's been a pattern for a season. And that's where hope has to take over sometimes. But continuing down that path, I think, is and seeing those things is what will sustain and what will build something that will last until Amber is 109, and hopefully I'm there too.
A long time in the future, although the way our kids are aging, 109 is probably just around the corner in actuality.
Yeah, it feels that way.
With the experience that you have had of watching Reshelving Alexandria be birthed and grow and burn and grow again, I'm wondering, with all the missions and everyone's lives that you have watched, what do you see as the value of home libraries?
I think the value of home libraries is particularly for the time we live in where it's not always possible to, within your community, have a shared set of values. Because I think in one sense, a public library reflects, you know, community-wide values, right? So I don't know that that's possible, you know, to share values with the community in every case when a lot of what, you know, for sometimes good reasons, a lot of what was previously put out as literature is now, you know, considered to be either just out of fashion or harmful or both, or just economically, you know, there are just economic reasons as well, sometimes practical things.
Or just outdated.
Outdated, out of fashion. You know, it's like the kitchens, right? Like your kitchen's more than 10 years old. It's outdated. Mm-hmm. Get new shiplap. Oh, wait, no, shiplap's out of date now too, by the way. I heard that somewhere. Sorry, Joanna Gaines lovers. All right. Guess I won't be making my pilgrimage to Waco. Oh, well. So, you know, given the external forces in the world, I think that finding something timeless in terms of what literature is, what you want to share with your family and your small community around you, and what you want to pass on, and even just keeping and having access to what has helped form you yourself.
Yeah.
I think that's the value of home libraries. Now, I knew none of this a few years ago, but Amber, you convinced me of that. So like, I know you've had that influence on a number of others as well. So I think that's a great work that you're doing, is bringing awareness to that concept and having that positive influence on others.
Thanks. Did you have anything else that you were hoping to share with the community?
Yeah, so I get that for practical reasons, like renaming a podcast maybe isn't like that good, you know, for subscribership and all that kind of stuff. But I'm just not seeing how we're building from ashes anymore. I think that this is like really taken off, and amazing to see what you've built here. You got that vision where it's just like, I'm going to start a podcast because, you know, I'm going to do that. And people are listening, and that's great. So, you know, I always say it's amazing how it's like, man, I don't think I have, you know, you list off your listenership every episode, and it's like, yeah, I don't think I have that many people who care what I think. So I guess maybe now I do. Thanks for that. But it's just, it's remarkable. So I know that, you know, when you birthed this, there was, you know, some circumstances that are maybe a little different, but I hope that you really feel like this has bloomed and grown, because that's what I'm seeing. So hopefully, you know, we'll keep the name. I guess it's a good name. Nice art,
yeah,
logo or whatever. But
since you brought it up, which I was not expecting you to do, the name actually had multiple meanings, which pretty much any name I come up with for anything does. And so while this podcast was birthed during a time of rubble where there had been some actions taken that were destroying a lot of what we loved in this community and had worked really hard for, it also was along the themes of reshelving Alexandria and how Alexandria was lost to a great fire, and we're all rebuilding. So we're all rebuilding our home libraries inspired by the ashes of Alexandria. And so in that way, it's still stories from the ashes. And I also think that probably the most powerful books that I have read in my life were written by people who had experiences of going through the fire. And so I feel that people like Corrie Ten Boom, who survived the Holocaust and wrote The Hiding Place, and then so many of the Messner biographies that I read when I was helping to build the list of all the Messner biographies and write reviews and tag them and content considerations for them. I was just reading all these lives of amazing, incredible people who did amazing, incredible things despite what they had been through, despite what they had experienced, despite all of the horrors that they had faced in the time and place and families and communities that they had lived in. And they kept telling their stories, even from the ashes. One of the Messners that I had read closest to starting this podcast was the one on Phyllis Wheatley by Shirley Graham. And her life is devastating. And I had no idea how her life ended and the end of her story. And it was heartbreaking, but her poems live on and they are beautiful. But many people would look at her life and just see despair and ashes. And so I think that it's encouraging. We talk about wintering a lot on the podcast and going through seasons of rest when our whole lives just feel like a storm. And so I think that we can take encouragement knowing the stories that God can bring out of the ashes of our lives. And those stories can live on even when the ashes are gone. And so our logo being the fire lily, which grows from ash and is just this incredibly beautiful flower. Highly poisonous, guys. Don't go eating it. It's not one of those lilies. But it's this beauty that comes from the ashes and remains. So I think that that's what I love about stories from the ashes, is that the stories are what we're left with. And the ashes blow away with time. Like, ashes don't stay forever. They go with the wind, but the stories are what we are left with. So that is my thoughts on the name and why I intend to keep it, whether we're in a season of ash or not.
Very nice. Very nice. Good to know. You probably told me that already, but I don't know. I just come back to
it's come up.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I appreciate that. That's great. But yeah. I just also see, like, you built something here. So that's good.
Thanks. All right. Well, thank you for your time, Eric, and for answering all of these listener questions and all your book recommendations. Here. Oh, I didn't. You're right. I touched on it there at the end and then I completely forgot. So, Eric, we have been asking our guests what they do for self-care. So what do you do for self-care?
I grill steak and I have a small glass of whiskey.
Yeah, you do. That works. I would also say
been making a lot of steak the last couple of years. Oh yeah. Yep.
Yes, you have. So our wood pile appreciates your self-care. Our bellies appreciate your self-care. And it'll be disappointing when we don't have as much Brazilian steak, but it'll also be a sign of good times. So there's always that.
Well, but see, once the skill develops.
Yeah. Then it's easy to keep it going. So do you have anything else that you want to share with us, Eric?
No, I think I'm good. Now, I haven't, maybe I've not had my fill of Amber pontificating in this episode. So is there anything else that you would like to share with us, the listening public?
Well, I think that it's always good to hear different people's journeys and how books have had an impact on their life and stories have had an impact on their life, even if they aren't big readers. I think that that can be encouraging. And I think that oftentimes people undersell the power of stories or don't recognize the impact that it's had. When we got married and I asked you what you had read in life for years, the only thing that you would own up to having read was Goosebumps. And so I believed you. Like, I thought that was all you had read, and I was just like appalled for you. But then as we had kids and you started reading to them, then you started being like, oh yeah, I've read this too. And oh yeah, I've read this too. And I remember when you told me that you had in fact read a classic and that it was The Great Gatsby and that you had really enjoyed it. And so I think I've purchased like 4 copies of The Great Gatsby for you at this point every year for St. Nicholas Day with like gorgeous illustrations. And one of these days you're going to read The Great Gatsby again and it's going to have pretty pictures. But just slowly as you have been remembering some of what you had read, I think that that's been fun. And again, I appreciate you reading all those picture books to the kids. And I also appreciate right now your reading through The Hobbit again, because the girls are just completely bonkers in love with all things Tolkien. And I know it means a lot to them that you are reading The Hobbit, because they tell anybody who will listen that you're doing that for them. And so I think that I read something once that said that the 6th love language that no one talks about is reading the book that your friend recommended to you. And I think that that's really accurate. And I just appreciate that you're doing that for the girls in reading The Hobbit, in, you know, their minds reading that book that they recommended. So I appreciate that.
Thanks, Amber.
So all the books that you recommended today that you have read, we will have in the show notes. And I'm going to go ahead and throw some of those beautifully illustrated copies of The Great Gatsby into the show notes as well. But those can also be found in the Reshelving Alexandria and Stories from the Ashes Amazon storefront. We have an entire list of our favorite illustrators for different reprints of the classics. And they're just straight up eye candy. So I like to just scroll through that list and look at all the pretty book options that are out there. But the Reading Rainbow episode on goats, I'm going to try to find that one and put it in the show notes. But otherwise, we'll be doing links to the Scholastic DVDs, which unfortunately, Scholastic in the last 5 years has stopped selling them. But we have found that a lot of them are still available at the public libraries. And so you can definitely look for those there. And we have found a whole bunch of YouTube channels that are also dedicated to all those Scholastic read alouds. And so we will add those to the show notes as well.
And so do us all a favor, smash that like button, smash that heart, smash that subscribe button. Don't break your phone, but just give it a good smash. Like if there was a bug on the screen.
That's right. Go smash the heart button on iTunes. I would love that. And thank you all for your time and for hanging out with Eric and I. And I'm sure Eric will show up again sometime. So feel free to submit
Thanks
more questions in the comments on the show notes. My pleasure. And remember, everyone, the stories are truer than true.